It's absurdly large, heavy, and expensive to build. So you have to ask, what is the point of Tiger 2?
When you've already got this.
With its combination of thick armour, massive firepower, Tiger 1 was already the toughest, biggest, meanest beast around. It was the stuff of nightmares for Allied tank crews. But at some point, the Germans decided they wanted to build an even bigger, tougher, meaner tank. This one, Tiger 2. And they're willing to pull production of Tiger 1 to get them made. So how are Tiger 1 and Tiger 2 related? What were they hoping to achieve by developing Tiger 2? And to what extent did they succeed? The main commonality between Tiger 1 and Tiger 2 is they were both designed and designated as Durchbruchswagen.
The idea goes back to 1935, and the concept of well-armed and well-armoured heavy tank, able to break up enemy armoured assaults and punch holes in enemy defences that could then be exploited by lighter vehicles like the Panzer III and Panzer IV.
They didn't have them in 1940 when they'd been able to do the job they were designed for, but the requirement became a lot more urgent in 1941 during the invasion of the Soviet Union when German tanks encountered the T-34 and this, the KV-1. So, with the German army on the offensive, the Tiger needed to be introduced quickly to act as a platform for the 88mm tank gun.
Based on the 8.8cm flak, which had proven itself in an anti-tank role in the early part of the war, the tank equivalent, the KWK-36, had the hitting power to deal with Soviet armour that was absent in the 37 and 50mm guns of early war German tanks, like the Panzer III. Running elements of different projects together, hull and mechanicals from Henschel, and a turret intended for a Porsche-designed hull, Tiger 1, Panzerkampfwagen 6, Tiger Ausführung E was born. When the Tiger 1 first appeared on the battlefield in August 1942, near Leningrad on the Eastern Front, it was a game changer.
The combination of thick armour and massively powerful gun outmatched any Allied tank in existence. We're all aware of the Tiger 1's legendary status. So why, just as it was established, would you want to start thinking about replacing it? When you already have a potentially world-class heavy tank, why start designing another? Especially in the middle of a war. With all the additional costs, industrial complications, and disruption that entails. Well, it seems there were two reasons.
Firstly, Tiger 1 wasn't capable of much upgrading. It couldn't really be upgunned. The turret was too small to take the new and more powerful 8.8cm KWK-43 gun. And the squared-off hull couldn't realistically be up-armoured without adding an excess of weight that would put massive strain on the drivetrain.
So impressive as it was, the design could go no further.
Secondly, while it would be wrong to describe Tiger 1 as a stopgap, it was hurried into production with the aim of supporting the invasion of the Soviet Union.
It seems that the Germans were looking for something to fulfil the role into the medium term, probably the next 5 to 7 years. Now that sounds logical, but it would sound even more logical if the war was actually going their way.
The replacement for Tiger 1, or Tiger Ausführung B, was ordered in early 1943, right at the time the tide of the war was beginning to turn away from the Germans. It was to be incredibly well protected, with even thicker armour, which would be sloped to increase its line of sight thickness, like the T-34 and Panther before it. It would also mount the new and more powerful 8.8cm KWK-43 L-71 gun, giving it far more destructive power. The initial turret for the Tiger 2 was, like that of the Tiger 1, also originally designed for another unsuccessful design from Ferdinand Porsche. It's a good job he was good at making cars.
This is that turret. Now, as 48 of these had already been built, rather than waste them, it is wartime after all, they were fitted to the first 48 Henschel hulls. This is the only survivor. This is the pre-production Henschel Tiger number 2. It also explains why these are sometimes known as the Porsche Tiger, despite the fact that Porsche had nothing to do with it at all.
The curved front was intended to reduce the area that could be hit by an incoming round, but instead it created a shot trap that would deflect the round down into the turret ring, with potentially catastrophic results. It was also harder to make.
So the rest would be fitted with the Serientum, the production turret. Now again, that is a Krupp design, but it's flat-fronted, so it eliminates the shot trap. Production of Tiger 1 was phased out as Tiger 2 came on stream. And Tiger 2 first saw combat in Normandy in June 1944. But how much of an improvement was Tiger 2? But before we do, a quick reminder. The Tank Museum is a registered not-for-profit organisation. Everything we do is made possible by you. If you'd like to help, become a friend of the Tank Museum. You get a range of benefits and you help keep icons like Tiger 131 running for the future. Click on the link to find out more. Now, back to the video. So how much better was Tiger 2 than Tiger 1? And how much better were these two against the Allied tanks they were facing? Now, better is obviously a very subjective word, but there are a substantial number of upgrades you have to take into account here.
The Tiger 1's KWK-36 L-56 gun, firing the tungsten-cored Panzergranate 40 APCR round, could punch through 138mm of 30-degree sloped armour at 1,000 metres. The Tiger II's KWK-43 L-71 gun, firing an APCBC round, could punch through 165mm of 30-degree sloped armour at 1,000 metres.
That is a substantial upgrade. Now, a Tiger I could penetrate the frontal armour of a Sherman at 1,800 metres. Now, that's impressive. But a Tiger 2 could do the same thing at 3,000 metres.
Both are therefore excellent in long-range encounters and easily outmatch the 75mm armed Shermans and T-34-76 that are unable to penetrate either Tiger's frontal armour at all. Tiger 1 has an exceptional degree of armour protection for its time. 100mm on the glacis, up to 140mm on the mantlet, but no real slope. The squared-off boxy hull means that the frontal plate has a minimal slope of 10 degrees.
With the emergence of the Sherman Firefly and the T-34-85 in 1944, it was no longer invulnerable when facing enemy armour. With the upgrade seen with Tiger II, that ensured that the German army would still be able to field a tank that would be. Now, with a hull shape similar to the Panther, the frontal plate is 150mm thick, and it's sloped at 50 degrees. That is a massive increase in line of sight thickness and also means that a ricochet off frontal armour is a lot more likely. The front plate of the Serientum is only sloped at 9 degrees, but in compensation for that, it's 180mm thick. What that means in practical terms is that no Allied tank is capable of penetrating the frontal armour of a Tiger II. Both have torsion bar suspension, but the road wheel arrangement changes from Tiger 1 to Tiger 2. Tiger 1 has a complex Schachtellaufwerk system, 8 sets of interleaved road wheels with rubber tyres. They give very smooth ride, but they're a nightmare to repair. If anything goes wrong, like a mine strike, you might have to take up to 9 wheels off to actually get at it. Now, with Tiger 2, it's simplified. 9 sets of wheels, but they are just overlapped, not interwoven. And the rubber tyres have been dispensed with. They're simply 2 steel discs with a rubber separator. That's not a bad thing when even ersatz rubber late in the war is in short supply.
Both Tigers are light on the controls, having a semi-automatic transmission and a double differential steering system, which makes the steering very responsive. Just like a car, according to Otto Karius, and a lot less jerky and slow than other tanks like the Sherman or the Panther. Tiger 1 was initially fitted with the Maybach HL210 engine, giving a top road speed of 38 kilometres per hour. Tiger II has the upgraded HL230 engine, which is also used on Panther, and was fitted to later production Tiger I's from May 1943. This increased the available horsepower from 650 to 700 and gave a top speed for Tiger II of 32 kilometres an hour, little different from Tiger I's 38 kilometres per hour. This is a fair bit slower than the 46 kilometres per hour for a Sherman or the 53 kilometres per hour of a T-34, but it is still pretty impressive for the weight.
Tiger II is roughly the same height and width as Tiger I, but it's almost 2 metres longer.
And with the extra armour and bigger gun, it's 11 tonnes heavier than the 57-tonne Tiger I, weighing in at 68 tonnes.
Weight was an issue for both. It put a strain on engine, transmission, pushing the whole system to its limits. And that led to mechanical breakdowns. Because of their complexity and the fact they were engineered to such fine tolerances, they were very difficult to maintain in the field.
Far more skill and specialist equipment were needed to maintain a Tiger than a Sherman or a T-34. And when things did go wrong, parts and spares were often unavailable, leaving badly needed assets unserviceable for protracted periods.
It's often suggested that weight meant indifferent off-road performance, especially where the going was soft or in deep snow.
In fact, both Tigers were equivalent to other German and most Allied tanks, such as the Panzer IV or the Sherman, when it came to crossing terrain, though neither would match the 29-tonne T-34 with its wide tracks and twisty suspension. Part of what adds the weight of the Tiger II is its large capacity fuel tanks. That means the road range of 170 kilometres is better than the Tiger I at 140 kilometres. But Tiger IIs are very thirsty, using 5 litres per kilometre on the road, as opposed to about 2 for a Sherman or T-34. This became a major problem when supply lines were long and fuel was scarce, making resupply difficult.
Between July 1942 and August 1944, 1,354 Tiger I's were produced, and 489 Tiger IIs between January 1944 and March 1945. So there weren't that many of either. Yet they've somehow left a big mark on our understanding of the history of World War II. Now, it's quite easy to overestimate the importance of the Tiger tanks. But let's take a closer look at some of these numbers and see if we can add a little perspective. Production runs of both Tiger I and Tiger II are small in comparison to the 50,000 odd Shermans and a similar number of T-34s produced by the Allies. But that by itself is not an entirely helpful comparison.
Because the Germans also built 5,774 Panzer IIIs, 8,553 Panzer IVs, 9,409 Stug IIIs, 1,139 Stug IVs, and 6,005 Panthers, amongst a host of other specialised variants.
The Germans never intended to flood their tank force with Tigers in the same way that the Allies were heavily dependent on particular types, like the Sherman or the T-34. That was a good job, because the production of Tigers was far more complex and labour-intensive.
This was partly because of the quality they aspired to, and partly because German industry lacked large-scale production facilities and still relied a lot on hand assembly. For example, Henschel had nothing like the US car and railroad factories that switched to tank production, or the Soviet factories at Chelyabinsk, Tankergrad, or Nizhny Tagil. It's often assumed that Allied air raids on German factories, which became more intense as the war went on, disrupted tank production to a large degree. In fact, the effect was only ever peripheral. Even when the Maybach plant was substantially damaged in a raid, engine production continued at satellite plants. But the German labour force was being stripped of its skilled labour as the need for more conscripts grew. German production was simply slower and more expensive. And these numbers make that abundantly clear. A Tiger I took around 300,000 hours to build, and cost 250,000 Reichsmarks. A Tiger II took between 350,000 and 400,000 hours to build and cost 321,500 Reichsmarks.
So it took up to 100,000 hours more, depending on factory and supply conditions, and was 30% more expensive to build a Tiger II than it was a Tiger I.
For Panther, the end-to-end production time is 150,000 to 200,000 hours. That's a lot less than a Tiger, but it's still a huge amount. It also cost 117,000 Reichsmarks.
A Stug III, highest-scoring tank killer of World War II, took between 1,000 and 1,200 hours to build and cost 82,500 Reichsmarks. So we're left observing that the shift from Tiger I to Tiger II was actually a pretty bold move considering changing German fortunes during the war. And we have to question the wisdom of going ahead when things were looking so much worse for Germany. On the other hand, a Sherman took between 10 and 12,000 hours to build and cost between $35,000 and $50,000. And a T-34 took between 3 and 5,000 hours to build and cost $25,000 to $35,000.
Putting this another way, in the time it took to build a Tiger I, you could build around 30 Shermans or 100 T-34s. And for the cost of a Tiger I, you could build just over 7 Shermans or 10 T-34s.
Of course, these figures look worse when you compare them to Tiger II. But it's worth remembering the Germans were not playing the game in the same way that the Allies were. Whereas the Allies sought to pump out what was good enough and were prepared to accept attrition, the Germans were looking for decisive battlefield performance from their Tiger tanks. And they were willing to pay for it. To them, this meant outgunning and outlasting the enemy and achieving higher kill ratios. Now, that is a good idea in principle, but perhaps not quite so sensible in a war that would be won by strength of numbers and logistic supply chains.
The mass-produced Sherman tank attained a serviceability of 80 to 90%. That's a tribute to industrial standardization and excellent supply logistics and training in maintenance.
Tiger I achieved 50 to 60% serviceability. With Tiger II, it's around about 59%. There isn't a lot of point in having the best kit available if it's unusable almost half the time. So, were they really worth the cost? Well, was Tiger II a success? Well, as a replacement for Tiger I, it can be regarded as a success because it offered increased firepower, increased armour protection, that meant it will remain dominant on the battlefield. No Allied tank commander would willingly engage a Tiger II from the front. And even the side and the rear armour provided a good degree of protection from US 75 and Soviet 76mm rounds, even at close range. In a simple head-to-head engagement, it really couldn't be bettered. But tank engagements aren't fought like that.
While excellent in the more open spaces of the Soviet Union, where it could destroy targets from a distance, Tiger II was more constrained when operating at much closer ranges in the rolling countryside of northwest Europe, where it's also more vulnerable to air and artillery attack. And this, along with mines, mechanical failures, or simply running out of fuel, is how most Tiger IIs were lost. As much potential as the Tiger II had, it could only achieve this if the situation allowed it air cover, infantry support, and it could be appropriately supplied with fuel, spare parts and ammunition, all of which were becoming increasingly challenging as the Germans were pressed harder by the Allies. In addition, to get the most from the sophisticated Tiger II, you needed an elite and experienced crew, but these could not be replaced at the speed they were being lost. By this point, training was being considerably compressed and streamlined, but the less the crew knew about their vehicles, the less likely they would be to use them properly, let alone be able to diagnose and repair even simple electrical or mechanical issues. The Tank Museum's Tiger II is a prime example of crew inexperience, the vehicle having been captured intact after the driver made a sharp turn at high speed and in the process stripped the final drive.
But of course, Tiger II was never really used for its designated purpose as a Durchbruchswagen, a heavy breakthrough tank. By the time it was ready, the German army was in no position to be smashing holes in enemy lines, with lighter armour moving forward to exploit the gaps.
There are a few exceptions, such as the Battle of the Bulge, where Tiger IIs played a key role in the breakthrough. But even here, they were crippled by fuel shortages, mechanical issues, and air attack.
But good as it was, and it was good, the German army didn't have the resources to support it in the field. And instead of being used in its designated role of a heavy breakthrough tank, it generally ended up fighting desperate defensive actions against hideous odds. Tiger II could be described as a tactical success for its immense strength, its ability to dominate the battlefield. At the same time, a strategic failure. It was resource hungry, incredibly expensive, actually very few in number. And that meant that it didn't have a major impact on the course of the war. Given their cost, it forces us to question whether the German war machine would have been better off dropping Tiger altogether in favour of building even more Panthers and Stokes. But what do you think? Let us know in the comments below.